Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Hashing Out the Law. This is actually the first episode we're doing in 2024. I'm very excited. My guest today is McCracken Poston Jr. And please correct me if I mispronounce it.
Poston.
Poston. Yes.
Yeah, that's okay.
How are you doing today?
Thank you, Hash. I'm doing great. I'm so happy to get to know you and be on your show.
Well, I'm happy to have you on here. Let's talk about a little bit about your background. Let the viewers and the listeners get familiar with you. You are an attorney. You're also a politician. I don't know if you're still in politics, but please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I grew up, born and raised in a place called Catoosa County, Georgia, which is immediately below Chattanooga, Tennessee, just inside Northwest Georgia. And grew up there, was always interested in politics and, you know, worked in campaigns when I was a teenager and ultimately went to law school and ran for office at age 28 and won. And I was in the Georgia legislature for four terms. While there, a lot of change happened. I developed type 1 insulin dependent diabetes. It's a perspective changer to have a realization of your own mortality at that age. And, you know, I started doing some kind of crazy things like Molotov cocktail throwing type things, trying to reform Georgia's government process. Georgia did not have any regulations on lobbying or making lobbyists register or reporting what they gave to us as legislators. You can imagine how popular that made me among my colleagues, but I passed it and brought Georgia's lobbying registration and reporting law to Georgia.
Now, let me ask you this. You talked about how you had to realize your mortality at a young age. Did that make you change your objectives or agenda as a politician on the Georgia? You were a part of the assembly, right? Georgia State Assembly?
Yes, it did. And it made me realize the old tradition in Georgia is just to stay down there forever. And then maybe one day the speaker would tap you and you would be the run for governor or whatever. It was a very powerful speaker that we had. It was a really great man, but he and I fought like crazy over the last of my years there. And I was young and impatient, and I would say mostly impatient, because I realized that if you didn't do something, your time there was going to be up. So I ran for U.S. Congress. And I like to say that I left politics due to illness. The voters got sick of me. and I was destroyed in this congressional race. And so here I was. I used to win my district. Once I won it by 70% of the vote. It almost completely flipped when I ran for U.S. Congress. I was completely defeated to where I just knew I was not going to be running anymore. And it was the actual night of that loss that I encountered a man that I had not seen in many years, Alvin Ridley. He was worried about people being downtown, worried about his dilapidated, shuttered TV shop, and he was out there guarding it. And he made a comment to me about, you know, you got beat, didn't you? And I thought, oh man, this is like the peak of my humiliation to have this guy who's kind of the town weirdo, the town malcontent, to have him comment on my loss. And so I just kind of, you know, dismissed him and went on.
Let me ask you a question. I'm sorry. Let me ask you a question. You said you hadn't seen him for a long time. So you knew him prior to that instance?
It's a small Georgia town.
Okay.
Everybody knew him. My sister went to high school with him. They were a good bit ahead of me. I was born their senior year. So I didn't know of him in school, but he had a Zenith television franchise and was a hell of a TV repairman in the age of picture tubes. And he was just amazing at that. But the technology changed. It went to solid state circuitry. And I think everybody realized that's really what happened to his business. Although in his mind, there was almost a Rube Goldberg diagrammic connection between his business loss and a bunch of ills that he claimed happened to him because of the government and because different people. It was a real paranoia and kind of almost conspiracy theory, not in a grand scale, just as it addressed him.
Right.
You know, they took my van. He was obsessed with a van that he lost, and he only lost it for 3 weeks. But when they brought it back to him, he refused to accept it. So this van is slowly going into the earth now. It's been over 40 years that he hasn't touched it. It is that kind of thing. The thing about it is, though, within a year of me trying to put my life back together and my law practice back together, there was suddenly a controversial discovery of he going to a phone stand and first calling a hospital in Chattanooga and then being told no, he had to call 911, that he didn't trust the local government in Ringgold, Georgia. But he reluctantly called 911 and reported his wife not breathing. The thing about Alvin, he has a very flat effect in his voice. And this was actually used against him at trial. It also, his emotional reaction was not in sync with what most of us would think it should be.
Right.
He seemed very flat about his wife being dead. And that was used against him at the trial. But now, getting to the trial was an ordeal in and of itself.
Right. You were talking about trial. So he goes and he calls 911. He says his wife is not breathing. And then please take us how he goes from that phone call to being charged for her murder.
Well, it took several months, but he was immediately suspect because nobody knew he had a wife. Nobody who was in office at that time remembered or ever knew that he had a wife. And it's a story that goes back to 1966 when Alvin married a young Virginia Hickey. She was 18. He was in his early 20s. He had just gotten back from the Army. He did not go to Vietnam. I think his Army sergeant might have realize there's something about this guy that would be really cruel to send him to Vietnam in the mid 60s. So he rolled out and came home and fell in love and married this woman. Well, she came from an extremely religious family, and they got their marriage license 3 weeks after Dolly Parton and her husband came to Ringgold, Georgia to get their marriage license. So that's our claim to fame in Ringgold, that Dolly Parton married there and it stuck. Right. And so we've got a giant mural to Dolly Parton. But Alvin and Virginia got their license about 3 weeks after Dolly and Carl got theirs. And they took up housing in an affordable local public housing project. And before you know it, they were at odds with her family. They were at odds with the housing authority. And this years of litigiousness began, where Alvin was constantly thinking everybody was out to get him and litigating, including litigating their eviction. The housing authority accused Alvin of not actually living there all the time, which violated their rules to be able to give out affordable housing. And so Alvin, of course, litigated it to a trial, to a jury trial. And on September, and in the meantime, they quit seeing her family. And her family was putting articles in the newspaper, "Our daughter is missing. Last seen with her husband, Alvin Ridley." And so they were enduring that type of thing Well, there was a jury trial, and I actually found witnesses from this 1970 trial and jurors, and I interviewed them, and they said it was the strangest thing in the world. Alvin is feverishly representing himself and litigating this eviction, and suddenly the judge just stops the proceedings and says, "Mr. Ridley, have your father there, go get your wife." And what happened was the whole eviction was caused by her parents, who were in the room waiting to see her be flushed out, and got the judge to flush her out. Well, whatever was said in that judge's chambers, September 15, 1970, her parents backed off. And Alvin and Virginia resumed for a while a very secluded life, this time with his parents. And over the years, one by one, his parents died. And then when his wife died, her remaining family, understandably, raised the issue of, "We think this man has been keeping our sister away from us." And I got it. I understood it. But teamed with how Alvin behaved, it suddenly became a criminal investigation. And 8 months later, he was charged with murdering her and accused of holding her in their home in the basement for 27 years, wow, not stepping outside. The last place she was seen publicly was in that courtroom, September 15, 1970.
They didn't have any children or anything?
No children. Virginia had epilepsy, right, and she had severe epilepsy, which of course was the first thing I thought about her death. And so I began to research epilepsy deaths, which thankfully are somewhat more rare now in the age of good medicine. And it's kind of like diabetes death that I would face if I wasn't maintaining my medicine. But so there was some thoughts that maybe Alvin had failed to provide her medication, and maybe, you know, caused her death indirectly and then directly. But the direct allegation was that he smothered or softly strangulated her, strangled her, I guess I should say. We went forward. Alvin was an extremely difficult client. And I know you're probably going to smile when I start talking about difficult clients, because we all have them.
Yes, we do. And, but I have a question for you. How did you end up representing him? Once he's charged, were you appointed? Did he hire you? How did you end up representing him?
3 days after her death, Alvin began to stalk me on the street. I would meet him at the same corner for 3 days in a row. And I knew this is not by chance, because I would never see the guy out. And then suddenly I see him 3 days in a row. I realized he was leaving a phone booth stand, the very same one he called 911 from. That was his base of phone call operations. And he crossed my path. I just kind of looked at him the first day, nodded to him the second day. And the third day I stopped and said, "Mr. Ridley, I'm sorry for your loss." And that just opened up. He just tuned up his face like a child, in that moment where a child's face is contorted, but they haven't got the breath yet to cry. That was what it was like. And he began to just list a series of a bill of particulars about how everybody had been done him wrong. And the sheriff and the social services had, and her family had, worried his father to death, and then worried his mother to death, and now they've worried his wife to death. And so it wasn't making much sense. And so my father, who the book is also about, my father always liked Alvin. My father was kind of he was a foundryman out of a big foundry in Chattanooga, but he also piddled. And he and Alvin had some kind of bartering relationship for TV repairs and TVs. And my dad would fix things for him, sharpen his lawnmower blades and stuff like that. And I remembered while talking to Alvin that he and I had had a conversation when I was a young teenager when he came to fix our TV and I was watching wrestling out of Chattanooga, a live wrestling program. And Alvin mentioned that he had recently met Andre the Giant. And he told me how much bread and eggs that he ate for breakfast. And I remembered it because I told my friends, hey, this weird TV guy, he says he met Andre the Giant. And he told said he eats this and that. Well, Alvin told me the story again, and I said, wait a minute, you're the guy that told me that when I was 13, and realized, yeah, you're the TV guy that came to fix our TV. Alvin was an interesting character. He was extremely sharp-minded TV repairman. He was incredibly gifted at that. But the technology changed from picture tubes to solid state circuitry. And that's really what happened to Alvin's business. But he interpreted it as I'm losing customers because of the way her family and the sheriff. Alvin ran for sheriff in 1984. And I was already interested in campaigns at that time. I was already working in campaigns. And I'll never forget, he was kind of considered a joke, disgruntled client. There's no telling what he's going to say. So everybody's, there's some people having fun at his expense, ready to jeer and, provoke him. And he mounted the courthouse steps to give his speech. And he had a little cassette recorder with him. And he first held the recorder up to the microphone and pushed the button. And it was a recording of one of the TV stations in Chattanooga's sign off, like 1 a.m. sign off that had the national anthem. So all his detractors had to shut up and stand up and take off their caps. And I thought it was brilliant. And then, of course, when he started rambling his conspiracy theories, people started jeering and, taunting him again. But I thought, man, this guy's got some natural political skills that he shuts them up and makes them stand up and honor our country. So I noted that about him in 1984. So here I am in 1997 into 1998, trying to get him to work with me. I
But let's go
thought,
back. Let's go back. So he's stalking you. You meet him
yeah.
3 days in a row. You start talking to him. You tell him, sorry for your loss. He starts to tear up. But what happens that you represent him?
Well, I thought, well, I'm likely, we didn't have a public defender system. So individual lawyers who'd been practicing a certain number of years, you could get on a list and get appointed cases. So I knew that I was about at the year that I could stop, get off that list, but the court asked me to stay on the list because they, first place, I'd been messing around in politics and hadn't pulled my weight. And secondly, they wanted some people, some older lawyers to be involved in it. So I took him over to the judge and I said, just from the looks of him, the dilapidated TV shop, the dilapidated home, that he wouldn't let me come in. I could tell this guy just probably doesn't have a penny to his name. So I took him to the court. And the judge says, well, Mr. Ridley, the detectives just left. I know you've got a $250,000 piece of property up in Chattanooga near the lake. And I turn and look at him like, you got to be wrong, judge. And Alvin says, well, mama never wanted me to sell that. So the guy's got assets. And the court tells him, I'm not going to appoint you a lawyer. So ultimately, Alvin gave me a security interest in the shuttered, dilapidated Zenith shop that had a giant hole in the roof. It had all four seasons of weather inside. It was muddy on the inside. It snowed inside one day. But that secured my interest. And I started having to pay out money for experts and things. So that's, I was getting a little desperate because I went ahead and started representing him before I had that secured. And something about him made me want to help him. And part of it was my father's friendship with him and my father's feeling that he was innocent. I didn't know at first, I thought people are capable of anything, and he's an odd bird. I never could figure out why. So, but Alvin would never let me into his home. He let the police in. He never would let me in. And so ultimately, many years after the trial, I learn or find out through a juror suggesting that Alvin be tested. Alvin is very much on the autistic spectrum, and it explained everything. It finally, the book formed in my head because I couldn't explain Alvin. I had been trying to write it for years. I had been engaging co-writers, and we just get to the point of, well, how do you explain him? I don't know. He's just the oddest, one of the oddest people I ever met. Looking back on it, knowing now about autism and learning more about it, his very autistic mannerisms were being used against him at trial.
So
The flat.
you mentioned the book. So you wrote a book about the trial. What is the name of your book?
Well, look, I have a Zoom room poster here. It's called Zenith Man: Death, Love, and Redemption in a Georgia Courtroom.
That's great. And then for the for
That's
the
Alvin and his wife kissing in a photo booth when they were engaged at a little amusement park that still exists here in North Georgia called Lake Winnipesaukee.
That's
And
awesome.
it's from a photo booth, and there's a photo inside the book of another pane or square from that strip, that photo strip.
Now, for the viewers and listeners, if you haven't heard about this, he was called the Zenith Man, and the trial that you were involved in, he was being charged with murder, thanks to your great lawyering skills and the evidence that you provided and the expert testimony, he was finally acquitted. And, but this trial wasn't just a trial in a small town. This trial was featured nationwide on all kinds of crime shows and different trial shows. Tell us the how
Because
did
of the salacious allegation of
right.
a woman held captive for 3 decades almost, the National Examiner tabloid, while I'm representing him, hoping for a fair jury, everybody's rushing to the supermarket to get this tabloid with the title "Sicko Holds Host Wife Captive 30 Years, Then Kills Her." And I would find that people just assumed that he had held her captive 30 years. And the only issue was, did he kill her? And I'm thinking, well, that's pretty damning. And it would be an easy stretch if you just already come into the trial assuming that he held her captive for 30 years. That's going to be an easy stretch to say, well, he probably killed her too. So I had to try to get this guy to work with me, and he would not. He countermanded everything I would want him to do. He wanted me to concentrate on ancient civil beefs and old civil litigation, the taking of his van, which he was totally obsessed over. He wanted me to reopen those things. And I said, Alvin, this is a murder trial. I have to get you to work with me on the murder trial, not the taking of your van. And he goes, no, you don't. And I said, why? And he goes, because I didn't kill her, but they did take my van. That was his logic. So in terms of apportioning our time, he wanted to go for the thing that he wanted to prove. So, but he would not let me in the house, Hash. It was so frustrating. I felt like I was going to be humiliated again. I had lost this congressional race. I'd fallen from what I hoped was high regard in the community to now walking around with this guy that everybody's afraid of, trying to humanize him. I would try to get him to go with me into restaurants. Alvin didn't bathe much. Another thing we learned that some autistic people do not like the feel of water touching their skin. And that's the way it was with Alvin. He doesn't like hush puppies, the food, the cornbread. It's the texture thing. And I didn't know why he had these, what I thought were just quirks, but now they make so much more sense to him, to me. I would get furious with him. But over the years and all the civil litigation, lawyers would start off for him and then they would quickly leave. And he would end up representing himself or pro se litigant. And so it was extremely difficult. It was 15 months of hell. But an amazing thing happened on Thanksgiving of 1998. The trial was set for the week of January 4th, 1999. I had nothing. He wouldn't cooperate. I had no explanation of why she never came out of the house. I had no explanation of what her life was like in the house. I wanted to take photos. He would not let me go. I got a phone installed to be installed in his house so that he wouldn't have to go to the phone booth anymore. He could call me. He could call me on my cell, which was Atlanta based, and he wouldn't have to pay long distance to call me. And it just made more sense. And it was, not nominal cost. But I was also thinking, when the phone guy comes, I want to be there. I'll have my camera, and the phone guy and I will go in the house to reinstall his phone, and I'll have the camera there. Alvin had better plans. He decided to get the phone installed on the porch, and he would not allow us to come in. The more I wanted to come in, the more he pushed back against me. And so, Thanksgiving 1998, I remarried in the middle of all this. She was a local girl. Her family was familiar with Alvin, a little concerned about him, and she was a little more than a little concerned about my association with him. But we're at my parents' for Thanksgiving of 1998, and my mother was preparing a plate and putting tin foil on it and put it in a bag. And my dad said, "We want you to take a plate to Alvin." Well, that's the last thing I wanted to do on Thanksgiving was go deal with him again because he had frustrated me to no end. But I went, took my new wife home, and I went to Alvin's house. Didn't call ahead. I just went. Went up these horribly creepy steps and beat on the door and just kind of always kind of stood to the side in case gunshot would come out. I just kind of didn't know how he was going to react. He opens the door, he sees me, and I said, "Hey, my parents wanted you to have some Thanksgiving food." Well, that's when I learned that Alvin is very transactional. He didn't just take the food. He knew that I had been wanting to get in that house, and he said, "Just a minute." And he shuts the door. I hear him inside just for a few seconds. And then he opens the door and says, "Come on in." And I went in, and as soon as my eyes adjusted, it was a very difficult house to be in. It was very closed, and it just had some pretty terrific odor. As soon as my eyes adjusted, I saw that a whole wall was covered in paper, just different pieces of paper. And as my eyes adjusted, I looked at it, and here's a poem, here's a letter, here's talking about the Waltons TV show on CBS, and here's a list of their cast. Here's a one of many references to the producer, former child actor Ron Howard. She really liked Ron Howard. These were Virginia's writings. And I said, "Alvin, who wrote this?" And he said, "Well, Virginia did." And I said, "Man, I gotta have this. This is explaining that she seemed kind of happy. She seemed, she boy, she sure wrote a lot." And I said, "Why did she write a lot?" And Alvin's answer was always, "Well, I guess the Lord told her to." And so he said I couldn't have them. And I said, "You're going to prison." if I can't have these. But still, I had to pay him $200 for the right to copy them. And that was a process that over at my office where first I spent about 4 days in a row in that house with flashlights trying to categorize. Here's something about supper. Here's something about, oh, here's one about the moon landing. Oh, which one? Here's another one about another moon landing. She documented life since the 1960s.
So her life, her life was all there documented. And if your parents wouldn't have told you to take him some food for Thanksgiving, you would have never seen it.
I would have never seen it. And he had made a shrine. He had made a shrine since the police had left months before. He just started trying to make a shrine of her writings. He directed me to the next room where they were stacked in cardboard boxes, her writings, just almost just stacked up. I estimated there were 15,000 to maybe 20,000 entries. There was something from every year. There was almost something from every month of 27 years and long and further back 30 years. And it was the most interesting stuff. But I had this problem in that he wasn't going to let me. I had to pay him to copy them. And I said, look, Alvin, you know, we have this thing, as you know, where you can substitute a copy once you, you know, get past the best evidence ruling.
Right.
Get a document marked for entry. You can ask the court to substitute a copy. I explained that to Alvin, and I said, we'll try that.
Now, I don't want to cut you off. We're short, we're running a little bit short on time, but I have a question. How did you get all of that admitted into evidence? How did you lay foundation for it?
Fantastic. Her sister was explaining that, you know, she was held captive. And I said something the effect was, well, you didn't see this, what I gave the state that, you know, she was writing poetry. She said, I don't think she ever wrote poetry. Her sister identified the handwriting. So it was just the fact that it existed and her sister wrote it and not for what was in it. And so, you know, the allegation was this woman was held in a basement. She wrote President Nixon about their eviction. And the HUD secretary wrote her back, referencing her letter to President Nixon.
That's awesome.
And she had every conspiracy theory that Alvin had. And I think she possibly generated them and convinced him to follow those theories.
So it was a
wonderful discovery.
We could go on for days and days, but we're coming up on to the end of our episode. I do want to make sure that the listeners and the viewers know your book is going to be published. It's going to be available February 22nd. How do we get our hands on it?
Well, you can pre-order it at any bookseller site.
Okay.
It's Zenith Man, Death, Love, and Redemption in a Georgia Courtroom. Redemption of more than one man. Redemption of a number of people.
I'm going to make sure that we have the link for it in the YouTube description and all the podcast description. I don't want to ruin it for anybody. I could talk to you about this for 8 days and days.
And I thank you. I do want to say that my call to action is better testing for criminal suspects and defendants to hopefully capture the autism and help explain the way sometimes they react to questions and interrogation.
I appreciate it. It was a pleasure having you on. I look forward to reading your book. And maybe one day I can pick your brain about this trial.
I'd love to.
Thank you.
Thank you.